time now for the interview portion of our program. As part of our three-part series on Hacking Through the Ages, InfoSec Radio is pleased to bring you part one of a two-part interview with Kevin Mitnick. Kevin Mitnick is most famous, of course, for being one of the highest profile people ever to be convicted of unauthorized access to a computer system. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Dan.
Kevin, there have been numerous accounts of your story over the years. Without rehashing the whole Shimomura Markov scenario, is it fair to say that what the public has read about you and what they think they know about you is, to some degree, fiction? What in your mind is perhaps the biggest few misconceptions that the public has about your story?
Well, there's been a lot of inaccurate reporting about me, and unfortunately, this inaccurate reporting kind of started with John Markoff of the New York Times, in which on the front page it was reported as fact that I, for instance, broke into NORAD, wiretapped the FBI, planted a false news story about Security Pacific Bank losing millions of dollars after being turned down for a job, amongst, you know, many other factors. And that's, you know, what I really, you know, have to say is, you know, on a percentage basis, I would say, you know, it's 50-50, 50% fact and 50% fiction. And what it really has come down to is I was kind of created into this national icon of being public enemy number one of cyberspace. And I can say that in all my hacking, I've never acted with any malice to try to profit, to attempt to make, you know, a red cent or intended to harm anybody. But that's not to say what I've done is right. You know, obviously trespassing into people's computer systems is wrong. But, you know, the Kevin Mitnick story has been very sensationalized and hyped up because, you know, people had agendas. The federal government needed to send a message and to kind of use me as a scapegoat to advance their own agenda. You had John Markoff and Tsutomu Shimomura. One of them kind of was on a personal vendetta, and probably both of them together would like, you know, wanted to make, you know, the profit off my story. So what a better way to profit if you can create a very interesting story using sensationalism and hype. And as far as I understand, Mr. Markoff and Mr. Shimomura made, you know, well over $1 million, you know, in publishing a book and also in selling movie rights based on that book.
The stories surrounding your alleged attacks against NORAD and other military installations, those stories seem to come, you know, right out of a Hollywood script. If you can comment, what's the real story behind that relatively widely held belief?
Well, if you believe federal prosecutors, they've actually, one prosecutor told a federal magistrate back in 1988 when I was arrested for hacking into Digital Equipment Corporation's EasyNet. I think now they're Compaq. And federal prosecutors represented to the court that I could simply pick up a payphone and whistle into the phone or use the DTMF, the touchtones on the phone, and launch nuclear missiles. And based on that story and several other myths, I was held in solitary confinement for eight months. The NORAD story is false. I believe it was a rumor that was started by an ex-associate of mine who was a phone freaker and just decided he would start a rumor. And you would think that any reporter worth his salt would have contacted NORAD and determined if this rumor is actually true. And of course it isn't. I would hope that NORAD wouldn't be susceptible to attacks, you know, externally, you know, or even internally, because of the, you know, nature of, you know, their job. But, you know, what I can say, it isn't true, and I don't think it's possible that any systems that would be classified or would control any type of, you know, air defense would be on publicly accessible networks. Then again, you hear about, you know, foolish mistakes even made by, you know, I think one of the ex-directors of the CIA, where he brought classified materials home and put it on his PC, which was linked to the internet. So, you know, I don't know, but I think it's highly unlikely.
One of the people, of course, involved in tracking you down was Shimamura. He's been pretty quiet on the entire affair since the publication of Takedown. Why do you think that he's remained fairly inaccessible to the media?
Maybe he's been hanging out with Julia lately. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe he's just doing computer security consulting for spook agencies or for whatever. Maybe for some reason he's maintaining a low profile. In my case, I have sincere belief that he broke the law and that he was intercepting my electronic communications without a court order. And there is an exception in the Electronic Communications Privacy Act that allows communication providers to intercept communications to protect their property rights. But when a federal investigation starts and the FBI becomes involved, it's not permissible for them just to have somebody that's a civilian doing intercepts without, getting court orders, because if that person has the intent to assist the government and the government has acquiesced and has knowledge of what that person's doing, they're in essence a de facto government agent, and that's what Shimamura was. He was working very closely with an assistant U.S. attorney, I believe his name was Kent Walker, in San Francisco, and they were sharing information, and Shimamura would have been unable to track my location down on his own. It required cooperation on parts of other internet service providers and public telephone companies. And without the assistance, without the FBI or the U.S. Attorney's Office feeding him, basically confidential information that they only were privy to, he wouldn't have been able to, locate my residence in Raleigh. And there's a lot more to the story, but in brevity, that's the point I wanted to make.
It's been widely assumed, of course, that you had something to do with the attack on Shimamura's machine. Did you have anything to do with that or the voicemail messages?
Well, I can't comment on the attack on his machine, but I can comment. I wasn't convicted of that, so I'd be kind of foolish to discuss that part, but I can discuss the voicemails. No. I do not know who did it, and I did not put anybody up to it. I had no knowledge of it, and I think it was just a huge coincidence that those voicemails were left at the same time his machine was being attacked.
Have you had contact with either Shimamura or Markov since your release?
No. Of course not. I do understand that John Markov was going to do a presentation called Kevin and Me at the Early Computer History Museum, I believe, at NASA Ames Moffitt Research Center. And once I found out that he was going to be doing a talk about me after I was released, and knowing that this man defamed me on the front pages of the New York Times and simply justifies it in any way possible. In fact, when he's usually put on the spot and asked, about these things, about NORAD and all these myths that he's, printed as fact or were included in the story on the front page of the New York Times, and he reverts to it, well, Kevin was reading my email. So it's like, does two wrongs make a right? Just because somebody reads your email, does it give you right to libel somebody on the front page of the New York Times? I don't think so, but to answer your question about whether I had any contact with Mr. Markov, no, but when I found out about this Kevin and Me talk that he was going to give, I contacted my attorney, and my attorney, we were going to file a civil suit, a libel or slander suit, probably would have been slander, if he were to propagate any of the myths that he's already created about me. And we put him on notice, and then it turns out that when he did give the talk, because a few of my colleagues attended it, he did not discuss me. And I believe the reason he didn't discuss me is because he knew he was put on notice, and I think he was well aware that we would have definitely filed a lawsuit against him if he did make any misstatements about me.
I think there's also some confusion about what exactly your status is right now. Most people think that you're on parole, but you're not. What exactly are the conditions of your release at this point in time?
Well, I'm on what they call supervised release. It's simply It's similar to parole or probation, but it's technically different, and it's for the purposes of my rehabilitation to protect the public, while probation is a form of punishment and parole is a form of punishment, supervised release isn't. I have many conditions of supervised release. One, that I cannot possess or use certain types of things like computer hardware, computer software, computer peripherals, personal data assistance, wireless communication devices, televisions that have internet connectivity. I can't work for any computer business in telecommunications, computer software, or in the computer business. I'm not allowed to act as a consultant or advisor to anyone that uses a computer, amongst, you know, several others. But I believe they're the most draconian conditions of supervised release, and depending on how they're interpreted by the probation department, you know, they can be interpreted in a sense that would be completely unreasonable. For instance, most recently, I was in court because one of my conditions was, as it is worded on the judgment and commitment order, is the defendant shall not act as an advisor or consultant to any individual or group engaged in any computer-related activity. Well, if you read it literally, that means if you use a computer, I can't advise you on how to, you know, fix your car. And I was contacted by several organizations, either that write articles on computer security related topics or to speak on my viewpoints of computer security. And the probation department initially was construing that if I speak or write about technology topics that I'm acting as an advisor or consultant. And we challenged that as being unreasonable, because when the court imposed conditions that I not act as a consultant, we believe that the court meant as a computer consultant, you know, which goes into a firm, assesses a problem, acquires, you know, the appropriate hardware and software, and configures it and implements it and troubleshoots it and does whatever is necessary to get, you know, the business that you're consulting firm to get their problem solved. And in my case, where it was kind of, working as a public speaker or a journalist, we thought was unreasonable. So we went to court, we challenged it. The court really send a message back to the probation department that they can't just do a blanket denial of these types of things, that they have to evaluate it on a case-by-case basis, which if you read between the lines really means, is there any danger to the public? The probation department didn't want me to travel, so still at this point they're not allowing me to travel, but they do allow me to speak and write about, you know, computer-related topics as long as I'm not traveling outside the Central District of California.
I think it's probably pretty obvious that you don't think that your rights or your privileges are being given back quick enough. How much longer do you have to endure the current conditions, and what would you like to see change between now and the end of your supervised release?
Well, I have up until January 20th, 2003, and what I hope is over time the probation department has the full discretion on all these conditions of supervised release. And in fact, every one of them is in their discretion, so if my probation officer thought it was safe that I could use a computer hooked up to the internet, then I could go ahead and engage in that. But I don't know how long it will take. For instance, when Kevin Polson was on supervised release, I think after like a couple years they allowed him to use a computer, and maybe after 2 years and 2.5 years they allowed him to use the internet. You know, I don't know with me. You know, they might just take a cover your ass approach and just decide to keep me under tight reins until my supervised release is up. And then once it's up, they have no control. Or they can decide to integrate me slowly and keep an eye on me. I have no idea what they'll do. Fortunately, I have a real good rapport with my probation officer, but since my case is of such high profile, of a high profile nature, I think any decisions in my case are made by, you know, several different people, going all the way up to the chief probation officer of this, you know, the Central District of California.
Assuming that the restrictions placed upon you as a condition of your parole are eventually going to be lifted, can we expect to see your version of the story in print or film?
Well, there's a problem there. As part of my plea agreement, I was kind of forced into entering this assignment agreement. In this assignment agreement, basically for 7 years, prohibits me from profiting off telling the Kevin Mitnick story, about telling certain aspects of it, which happen to be the most interesting. And I'm going to have an attorney eventually, when I get some funds, to hire an attorney to really look at that agreement, because since I've already completely paid off my restitution and there's no civil judgment from the alleged victims against me, there's no outstanding monies owed. And the only purpose of the assignment agreement was, if I were to, you know, make a windfall by publishing a book or doing a movie or doing some other commercial venture that talked about my unauthorized access into computer systems, that those monies would go to the victim. And we had a real big problem because, you know, we believe that the losses, that the damages that the government alleged were completely, were grossly inflated, and that the victims and the government were in collusion because of some of the documents we received by subpoena. And the government basically largely based their claims of this large loss is based on the research and development costs of the software that I merely accessed. And I can say that the government has never accused me of using any source code, distributing it, selling it, or offering it for sale to anyone at any time. So with that said, I look at this as kind of like a breach of confidentiality, being a computer snoop, a computer trespasser, rather than engaging in some sort of like theft of trade secrets, which I think there's a huge distinction there because of the detriment, you know, to the victim. So is it fair to say if somebody read something they shouldn't have read, or accessed, you know, some proprietary information but kept it to themselves, is it fair to say that these companies have suffered losses of all the costs, the time and cost incurred to develop that information? I don't think so, because I think a good analogy would be if George Lucas came out with they were developing a new sequel to Jurassic Park, and an attacker went into their computer systems and had an advanced version of the screenplay and read the screenplay but never had the intent of using it or distributing it for any other purpose. What has, you know, Lucasfilms lost? Well, potentially maybe a one-sale ticket if the person didn't like the screenplay, and probably a gross invasion of privacy. But did they lose the millions of dollars invested in, or, you know, maybe the thousands of dollars invested in developing the screenplay? I wouldn't think so. And the more important point is, when we were trying to expose the government's misconduct in inflating these losses, because we had evidence that they were soliciting companies to provide the R&D costs as the damages rather than the real damages incurred, the government sought and the court granted a motion putting all the exhibits and pleadings that have the monetary damages under seal, which are still under seal today. And I'm going to be making a request of my attorney to try to unseal these records, because I'd like to, you know, get the truth out that the government inflated these losses as part of their plan to make me the poster boy for computer hacking. And that's not to say I haven't caused any damage, but I don't think it was anywhere near, you know, $100,000, let alone $300 million, as the prosecution claimed on an episode of 60 Minutes that profiled my case.
You had a lot of support over the years, certainly during your incarceration, from the black hat, white hat, any shade of hat community. How much impact do you feel that the Free Kevin movement had on your case?
I think it had a lot. You know, I had a lot of supporters behind me because they realized that my constitutional rights were being disregarded, that I was being treated in a very harsh way by the federal government, and a lot of the, you know, community kind of understood what I was being accused of, and I think the community knew a lot of people were doing that, were, you know, accessing source code trees that they weren't supposed to look at for their own, you know, enjoyment, you know, getting, you know, kind of as a trophy and trying to study the ins and outs of the code. And I think the notion that I was held in solitary confinement in a past case for months based on an absurd claim that I can launch nuclear missiles, and that I was being denied a bail hearing. In a bail hearing is a statutory and constitutional right. And even though it's probably very likely that even if I was permitted to have the hearing, that I might have, you know, I probably would have been denied bail. But the idea that the courts would just decide not to even allow me to have the hearing because the government has the burden of proof and the burden of persuasion to say that it, you know, to prove or to persuade a federal court judge that the person proposes or poses a flight risk or a danger to the community, and they have to meet this burden, and it's kind of like a mini trial where the defendant has a right to testify, to proffer evidence, to cross-examine government witnesses, and present evidence that the person, that there's a condition or combination of conditions that will reasonably assure that person's presence at trial. And I never had the opportunity to have a detention hearing, and I think a lot of people were upset by that fact because they saw or they realized if Kevin Mitnick could be denied a bail hearing because of the hype and sensationalistic reporting in the New York Times and because the government had an agenda, you know, of creating a hacker poster boy because of, I think they wanted to have a case where, you know, they could hold up as a deterrent, that they can go ahead and disregard the rights of their individual citizens, that it could happen to them. That if it could happen to Kevin Mitnick, it certainly could happen to any one of us. And I think that brought in a lot of support.
You've been listening to part one of an interview with Kevin Mitnick. Part two will air on the next edition of InfoSec Radio. That brings